From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. When you pored over the newspapers the week after September 11th, you may have noticed something was missing. Where were the gossip columns, the Angelina Jolie quote of the day, the star sightings? And what about our fascination with the famous?
I think that there might be a shift in taste a little bit, you know, in Hollywood. And that's nice to see. It's nice to see them recognizing that maybe things aren't exactly as they were and that we maybe need to refocus a little bit on what we really call a hero.
I mean, see, they're good people. They make you laugh. You know, like they're actors. Acting is to make you laugh. So they'll continue to act to make you happy.
The Hollywood celebrity that everybody's kind of used to is kind of an untouchable hero that you could never be.
Today, we take the pulse of celebrity culture, from the lives of forgotten celebrities to a look at our cultural quest for fame.
Most people are a little bit miserable all the time. Like, they have sort of a low-grade flu because they're not famous.
Cultural critic Cynter Wilson is appalled by America's obsession with fame. According to Wilson, celebrity is nothing more than a grotesque, crippling disease. It's also the subject of her book, A Massive Swelling. Steve Paulson asked her if the September 11th terrorist attacks would dampen enthusiasm for celebrity culture.
People were sort of really quick to say that on one hand, and then on the other hand, there was all these, you know, this immediate rash of news stories about how did this attack affect the celebrities and what are the celebrities feeling right now? And I felt like there was a real urge on the part of the media to drag celebrities into it in any way that they could. And I felt that many media services were probably secretly a little disappointed that the celebrities weren't a little more damaged in the attacks.
I remember hearing some comments that this meant that the death of celebrity culture, that we'd never be able to kind of laugh and just yuck it up again after the tragedy.
I think everybody thinks that for a few days, but, you know, it's already starting to come back. I mean, we had that monstrous telethon that, you know, every other station that didn't show the telethon had this FCC sort of dark box on because you weren't allowed to not show the telethon. I mean, I think that there's been a lot of lip service paid to, yes, celebrity is no longer very important because now we know what real life is, but yet we are still clinging to celebrities as hard as ever because they are how we learn how to deal with things emotionally. I mean, movie stars are the only people who have dealt with enormous explosions and buildings falling down. And so, you know, we turn to Marky Mark and we look to him for emotional cues on how to react to this disaster. Because he's dealt with it.
Now, one thing that we've heard is that the zealots, apparently responsible for the terrorist attacks, really hate our popular culture and the stuff that we export around the world. And I guess I'm wondering if you, I know you've lived in L.A., if you think the movie executives and the stars in Hollywood are suffering any pangs of guilt for what they've done over the years.
Of course not. I mean, I don't think so. I mean, we have always manufactured these images through which we live vicariously in terms of movies and things. I mean, what I think we might see a rash of now, my mother and I were talking about this, she thinks that there's going to be this rash of Westerns now all of a sudden. Like, you know, now for a long time we've had these sort of cuddly anti-heroes who are sort of morally impure, but you like them anyway because they're sort of funny and they are nice to dogs or something. And there's been this real dearth of John Wayne type heroes where you ride in on the white horse and you're actually really macho and brave and things like that. So I think that we're going to see more John Wayne-esque Western-style things. And then on TV, I think what you're going to see is probably a return to these Little House on the Prairie-style formats where you see a little family bravely coping on the plains from the attacks of engines or, you know, whatever. It'll be politically incorrect. So, I mean, something politically correct, but along those lines. And it's going to be the same story, except now there's going to be a return to real heroism as opposed to anti-heroism.
Well, let me step back from the events of September 11th and just ask you some about our obsession with celebrity. And I suppose that just about everyone has fantasized about becoming really famous at one time or another. Why do we want it so badly?
I think that in the United States, it before the attacks, and now we're all kind of thinking about things differently, but my contention was before that really celebrity or fame was the only thing that could redeem your human life. I mean, no matter what career you had, pretty much. I mean, if you were on TV, then you were really a success. If you were a household name, I mean, I think your mother even loves you more if you're famous in the United States. And so, you know, it's the only thing that can truly avenge you from all of your, like, ex-girlfriends and the people who tormented you in high school is to have a billboard of yourself somewhere.
What do you think this culture of celebrity does to the rest of us who aren't famous? Do you think we suffer for it?
Oh, absolutely. I think that most people are a little bit miserable all the time. Like, they have sort of a low-grade flu because they're not famous. It's a resentment that we all feel. Because really, we're supposed to live vicariously through this handful of, like, I like to say it's a deck, like a deck of cards. Like, the deck of celebrity has 52 heads, and they just kind of get shuffled and reshuffled, and, like, a different five end up on the top. They're on the cover of every magazine in the world for a while. And then they go back to the bottom of the deck, and a few you haven't seen in a few months come back to the top of the deck. But so, you know, say there's 52 people in the world who get all the love and the clothes and the admiration and the fun and the award ceremonies and, you know, attention. Everybody wants that much attention and love, and everybody probably deserves it, you know, but only 52 people get it.
Now, one of the scariest things to me is the extent to which some people chase after celebrities. And you write about some of these people, for instance, the girls and even the older women who just fall in love with groups like New Kids on the Block.
Oh, it's creepy.
Tell me about some of the mail that you've seen.
I devoted a whole chapter to this box of fan mail that a friend of mine gave me. Like, this fan mail distributing service moved out of his apartment, and then he moved in, and there was this box they left behind. So he gave it to me, and it was all these letters to New Kids on the Block. And some of them were, like, from these moms, you know, like these clearly like 42-year-old moms to like Donnie Wahlberg saying, "Oh, Donnie, you're so fine. I've lost 126 pounds now, and I really think if you could see me that I could be the one for you. And my daughter, Shannon, you know, she really loves you too, but I keep telling her that she should really fall in love with Jordan because Jordan's more her age." And, you know, just these really weird, demented things where, like, the entire family has this obsessive crush on New Kids on the Block, and they fight over which one is more fine at the breakfast table. And, you know, mom is more vocal than anybody. And
you read these letters, and they seem to be serious.
Oh, yeah, they're really serious. And, I mean, famous people become this sort of focal point for people who have nothing particularly going on in their lives to really cling to. And sometimes it just gets into this, like, demonically weird way. I mean, everybody who is famous, I think, gets really disturbing, creepy fan letters that, you know, their handlers or managers have to keep away from them. But it's a big part of the demographic. I figure probably like a tenth of fan letters are probably extremely unhealthy.
And then something peculiar happens to some of these celebrities, and I suppose Michael Jackson is the obvious
poor
case.
Poor Michael Jackson. Yeah, I mean, I like to say about Michael Jackson that the X-ray eye of fame really stared him crispy. I mean, he's such an interesting case only because he represents sort of like the best and the worst of fame, or like a really vivid example of what being famous your entire life can do to you if you're not an extremely stable person to begin with, because he was such a totally brilliant child. I mean, just an incredible performer and so much life and so much joy. And then now it's like he's really defaced himself, both sort of literally and figuratively.
You have written quite a withering account of what goes on at the Academy Awards. And I'm wondering what you see when you watch this event.
Oh, God. It's almost like this terrible fascist propaganda ceremony to me. It sort of looks like a big fascist rally of some kind. I mean, I feel like the rest of America is totally enslaved and subordinated to the entertainment industry, and we're already like these sort of serfs looking through the window of the palace, you know, from the vantage point of like the snow and the hunger and the cold and all these like sort of gleaming golden people dancing inside.
But we all laugh at them. I mean, it's not as if we're taking it seriously.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, like, maybe not on the coasts. You know, we're sophisticated people, and we don't take it very seriously. But I think a lot of people get, you know, really excited about the Oscars and really want to see what Gwyneth is wearing and things. And I resent it. It makes me feel like a slave. You will watch the Hollywood Awards ceremony. No.
So what don't you like about it? It's so over the top, or these people are taking themselves so seriously?
Oh, it's this terrible, unregenerate orgy of self-congratulation that sort of rattles my every last nerve. I mean, these people already have everything, and then they get to sort of, like, suck up to each other and overwhelm themselves with, like, how wonderful they think each other are for a whole night. And then we have to watch that as if it doesn't go on at every party that they have anyway. It's it's more of the same party that we don't get to be at.
And the fashions may change from one year to the next, but in a lot of ways, all the ceremonies are exactly the same. There's Jack Nicholson sitting in the front row or the second row with that same leer, and Warren Beatty's lurking somewhere around, and there's just this weird sameness.
You know how there's this giant squid at the Museum of Natural History? Like, they found this giant frozen baby squid, and they built this tank for it that's filled with grain alcohol. It's like this 8-foot glass tank. And I always think that that's probably what they keep Jack Nicholson in, like, you know, 11 months out of the year. And then they pull him up, you know, with a crane, and then they iron the tuxedo right onto his body, and then they lower him down into that aisle seat at the Oscars every year. And he's just, you know, perfectly pickled for that occasion.
Now, you're kind of famous in your own way. Now you've written this book,
not.
A Massive Swelling. You know, isn't that partly why people write books? So they get accolades and get their name out in print and all of that?
Dude, one does not get famous by writing a book of nonfiction essays, which is buried down in the lower right corner of the cultural studies bookshelf in your nearby Barnes & Noble. Sadly, I hate to tell you, I'm still struggling.
But if it happened that your book ended up on the bestseller list or the next one that you write, you wouldn't object, would you?
To fame? Certainly
right.
Not. No, I mean, like, I think I'd probably be really an atrocious and horrible celebrity, like, comparable to the worst celebrities that I threaten and jolly and assail. So, yeah, I mean, none of us are immune. Basically, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely, and if you're famous, you're just going to turn into a wanker at some point.
Cindra Wilson, speaking with Steve Paulson about her book, A Massive Swelling.
A small town in the Rockies, the Snake River Grill. My friend and I were leaving, we were stuffed to the gills. We walked toward the exit, the door swung open wide. Another couple is coming in, now I'm eye to eye with Harrison Ford. The only living movie star I've ever adored, Harrison Ford. He's stepping back, he's holding the door. Harrison Ford takes all my concentration not to fall on the floor at the feet of that fabulous mega movie star, Harrison Ford.
It's Christine Lavin singing Harrison Ford, but you don't have to be a Harrison Ford to make it as an actor. For Bruce Campbell, a couple of college buddies, a handful of investors, and a whole lot of fake blood were enough to make a cult movie classic. Recognize this scene?
Hey, I'll swallow your soul! I'll swallow your soul! I'll swallow your soul!
Swallow this.
A scene from Evil Dead. We'll meet Bruce Campbell in a few minutes. First, pop poetry. According to Jim Elledge, the literary world has no reservations about welcoming pop culture with open arms. Elledge and Susan Swartout are the co-editors of Real Things, a poetry anthology that includes poems about Rapunzel, Michael Jordan, Rita Hayworth, Frankenstein, Coca-Cola, Marilyn Monroe, and Superman. Elledge told Dan Strangechamps about some of them.
There are many, many, many out there, and popular culture seems to be a topic that seeps into American poetry in very important kinds of ways, I think, and at all kinds of levels, too, younger poets as well as poets who have been around for quite a while.
Some of them are really kind of heartbreaking also. I'm thinking there's one about Michael Jackson that also takes a pop culture, a pop icon, to a kind of, I don't know, level of psychological intimacy that's really sad in this case. Maybe you could read that one. It's called Neverland by Yusef Komunyakaa.
I'd be happy to, and I think you're right, it is a very sad poem. I don't wish you were one of the Jackson Five tonight, but only that you were still inside yourself, unchanged by the vampire moonlight. So eager to play the other, did you forget Dracula was singled out because of his dark hair and olive skin? After you became your cover, tabloid headlines grafted your name to a blonde boy's. The personals bled through newsprint across your face. Victor Frankenstein knew we must love our inventions. Now, maybe skin will start to grow over the lies and subtract everything that undermines nose and cheekbone. You could tell us if loneliness is what makes the sparrow sing. Michael, don't care what the makeup artist says. You know your sperm will never reproduce that face in the oval mirror.
What made you choose this one for the anthology? What did you like about it?
You know, Michael Jackson is a figure that has been important in our culture for many years. Now, whether you like him or dislike him, or whether you like his music or not, it doesn't really matter. He is, as a figure, an important individual. And I liked what you had to say about it earlier, that this really is a very sad poem. I think that Komunyakaa really gets at the gist of Jackson's life on a very important kind of level, kind of self-hatred, causing him to recreate himself into some kind of a creature like Victor Frankenstein did with his creature. Frankenstein, of course, used other bodies in order to produce the creature, whereas Jackson used his own, of course. And there's a huge sadness there, I think.
Are there any particular poems that are special favorites of yours that you'd like to read today?
I mean, all of them are at this point, so it's really hard to decide. I like a lot. Actually, there are two that I really like. One is Bill Trowbridge's poem, Viet Cong. And it's a play. Actually, Kong is spelled K-O-N-G. And it's a play with King Kong. The poem is one of a series of, I think, 12 poems, all dealing with King Kong and all dealing with his, quote, life after the movie is over, the original King Kong. Hmm. And in these series of poems, King Kong tries to get on with his life. He goes to a video dating service, for example, to try to find a date. He tries to get jobs, so he joins the Marines at one point and isn't very good at it. He sticks out too much. He goes to a talent agency, and there are no parts for an individual such as himself. But in this particular poem, Trowbridge tackles something slightly different, I think. But I'll read Viet Cong. Each one showed me his gold medal, talismans from the FBI. A name too holy for them to say. These agents wish to trade questions for answers, something like the cult of Jeopardy. Why do you spell it with a K? They asked. I told them I knew the state capitals, but I did not know spelling. I asked if I could try another category, perhaps state capitals. They said they believed I was being smart, which is taboo, that I could remain silent. I take this FBI to be a jealous god, full of paradoxes and taboos, but perhaps not so good on state capitals.
That's really
great.
Isn't
that great? I love it, too. It's truly wonderful. There's another one in here that I really like, Vanna White's Bread Pudding. And it kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier about how recognizing or how idealizing certain icons makes us or can make us feel as if we are sharing in their celebrity, their status, and all their good fortune. And this poem is called Vanna White's Bread Pudding. If not famous ourselves, oh, let us nudge up against stars and starlets everybody knows, everybody envies for all the sweet attention they receive. Like when in Mother's Restaurant, a table opened up for us, lucky guys. Next to the table in the corner were three good-looking women sat, attended by some sharp fellow and looks from all the other patrons. Damn if we didn't set down our gumbo and red beans and cold Dixie beer beside the TV personalities in town to do business and enjoy good food. Damn if it wasn't Vanna White herself sitting there in the flesh, in pink, face from the Wheel of Fortune weeknights, figure that turned the letters round and turned all the heads and mothers and drew a chorus in whispers, Vanna White, Vanna White, Vanna White, next to us, not an arm's length away. And when the owner himself came over insisting she try the famous bread pudding, despite her protests, despite her trim waist, despite the waste she hated to see. Damn if Anna didn't turn, smiling, and offer her bread pudding to me. To me. Damn if I didn't say thanks and take it. Damn if it wasn't sweet, buttery, hot, and therefore gone in a wink, like a star falling into my heretofore, but no more, anonymous lap.
Vanna White's Bread Pudding, read by Jim Elledge, co-editor of the poetry anthology Real Things. And Strange Champ spoke with him. Recently, he's gotten roles on The X-Files, Xena, and Ellen. Not bad for a so-called B-movie actor. Bruce Campbell, coming up. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Being an actor isn't necessarily about winning Academy Awards or owning mansions. Sometimes, it's simply about getting paid to do what you love. Fame is an extra perk. Bruce Campbell earned his share of fame the hard way. He broke through playing the character Ash in the indie horror movie The Evil Dead, the story of a group of young adults harassed by malevolent spirits in a mountain cabin. Here's Campbell as Ash, attacking the fiends with his trademark chainsaw.
Who's laughing now? Who's laughing now?
Evil Dead was just bad enough to be camp and just good enough to become a cult hit with a couple of sequels. Campbell writes about it in his new book, If Chins Could Kill, Confessions of a B-Movie Actor. He says, you don't have to be a superstar to get by as an actor.
Hey, folks, come on. There's a lot of coverage about all the Bruce Willises and Steven Spielbergs and guys like that, but for every one of those jokers, there are thousands of actors who actually do make a living that entertain us in all kinds of ways that we don't even remember, don't even know, anywhere from local car commercials to, you know, dancers at the Emmy Awards. And there's a lot of people who are all the support group, and there's, you know, you take a movie, Air Force One, starring Harrison Ford. Well, you look at the end credits, there's hundreds of actors in that movie and in every big A movie, but no one knows who they are, no one cares. They're all the supporting cast, but these are people who are trained, they're good at what they do. It's just no one cares.
And without them, those movies wouldn't be any good, actually.
Well, there wouldn't be a movie. Yeah. And the same people with the crew behind it. I try and acknowledge the crew in making movies as much as any of the actors, because they're just as important. I mean, the boom guy, if he screws up, you've got to replace that line later, and you might have liked how you did that line. Or the camera guy, you know. You can do the greatest performance in your life, but if you haven't told the focus puller where you're going to be going during your take, and as a result, you get out of focus, then it's your own fault, because you haven't acknowledged them. I make it a point, hey, what's your name? Hey, how are you? You know, give them, you know, candy and Tic Tacs in the morning, whatever it takes to bond with these folks, because they can be your closest allies. And I think There's this whole royalty thing set up with big movies that, you know, oh, shh, quiet, quiet, so-and-so's on the set, don't talk. It's like, get out of here. You know, there's a lot of information that has to go back and forth between people. You know, with a focus puller, I'd usually say to them, okay, I promise I'll only get this close to the camera, and I promise I'll only go this far back, but I need this range to do my thing. And they'll go, fine. You make a deal with them.
How much of this is because you got into this so early? I mean, when you and your friends began making movies back when you were in, what, eighth grade?
Yeah.
Did you even know then what a focus puller was?
No, we didn't. Of course not. No. But by being involved in doing those crappy little independent films in high school and junior high school, and then meeting guys from other neighborhoods, because high school was a, junior high is a collection of grade school neighborhoods, and high school is a collection of junior high school neighborhoods. So we started meeting myself and Sam Raimi and Rob Tappert and then these other guys who were featured in the book that we met in class and had the same similar interest. We all did everything on the movies. There were no set jobs. The producer was just someone who bought the most film, you know, or who made the most phone calls. We needed a bunch of people for a pie fight. Okay, I'll make some calls. So, okay, I guess you're the producer. The one who came up with the most ideas is pretty much the writer. We had two or three directors, but eventually one would just get credited. So it taught us to do a bunch of different things.
Let's talk about Evil Dead for a little while, because that was your first big filmmaking.
That's right, our first film, period.
Your first film, period. But that was your entry into the world of filmmaking.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like it was what you expected it to
be. Nothing was, because we had no expectations. It was more like, geez, we got money from real investors. They signed a real piece of paper. This wasn't some lend me $5,000 to go make a movie. This was sign on the dotted line, $10,000 a piece. We told them what we intended to do with the money. We told them when we thought we would get it back.
How many of you were involved at the beginning?
Three of us, myself and Sam Raimi, who I had met in drama class in high school, and then Rob Tappert, who was a Grosse Pointe kid, who I met once Sam went to college at Michigan State.
What did you have of the movie when you started? Did you know what you were going to do?
We had a script. We had done a prototype on Super 8 because that was our millimeter of choice. We did about 50 Super 8 movies in high school, ranging from comedies to war films to dramas, detective films, pretty much everything. But we thought, okay, if we're getting real money from real investors, let's make one of the great staples of the movies. You can either pick a comedy. They've always made comedies, dramas. We didn't think we were good enough at any of that. We thought, well, with a horror film, you don't have to have name actors, because George Romero did it with Night of the Living Dead. Who knew any of those people? Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Who knew any of those people? Toby Hooper got these friends of his from Texas.
Well, and you're going to cut their heads off anyway.
Yeah, it's the same with John Carpenter. We're making Halloween. Who was Jamie Lee Curtis other than Tony Curtis's daughter? It's like, big deal. Yeah. So we knew that we could make a movie cheap, and we knew that even if there was nobody in it that you recognized, chances are you could get it sold. But as a result, though, we said, okay, but we don't want to make a mainstream horror film that will get lost in the shuffle. We want to go for the gold here. No holds barred.
So what was going to be different about it?
It was going to be literally no holds barred. It was going to be, frankly, a gore fest.
Ash, it's not going to let us leave. We're all going to die here.
No, we're not going to die.
We're all going to die. All of us.
No. We're not gonna die. We're not gonna die. We're gonna get out of here.
Don't you see? Ash, they're alive.
We did a lot of research at movie theaters, at drive-ins, some of the last remaining drive-ins in the late 70s in Michigan. If there was a boring spot in the movie, these people, they'd turn their headlights on and honk the horn and scream obscenities out their windows. And we went, okay, let's keep this thing moving for people. So we decided, if we're going to get into the horror world, let's not pussyfoot around. Let's go for it.
So at the point where they're going to start turning their headlights on,
something
more
happened.
Blood pours off the screen.
Kind of. There was a guy, Andy Granger, who was one of these crusty old exhibitor types that Rob Tappert's family knew. His mantra was, as a theater owner, if it's a horror picture, keep the blood running down the screen. He didn't care about the plot, didn't care about anything, but keep the blood running.
You made this film. It took you longer than you expected it to. you lost some people as you went along, and after that they were still in the movie but shot from the back or something like that.
Yeah, we did a whole series of pickups with people who were not them. The original shoot was supposed to be 6 weeks long, and it went 12 weeks long. So we had people who had to go back to school. They had jobs they had to go back to. They went home for the holidays. They were like, forget you guys. So we shot whatever we needed to from the front, and then from behind, we just used other people. They put the shirt on. They put a wig on or whatever.
There was a name you used for it from the Three Stooges?
Yeah, they were shimping. Shemp was a member of the Three Stooges at one point. There was Mo, Larry, and Curly is what most people remember. But Shemp worked with them for a time. They would make a bunch of them at the same time, and Shemp had a heart attack and died. So they had to finish off three or four shorts with a fake Shemp, a guy who just came in and covered up his face really poorly. And then Mo, just to get him out, would go, Shemp, go guard the door. And he'd go, right. And they would dub in his old lines until he got out of the shot. And even we used to watch it every day after high school, and we thought, what is with that? We noticed, because we were starting to notice editing and filmmaking techniques, we went, that guy's not Shemp. So we just used that term for anyone who was in your movie that you couldn't recognize. So if we had a guy's feet walking across the floor or a hand on a doorknob, we put their name in the credits under fake Shemps. So, and we kept that credit to this day.
Yeah.
All extras would be fake Shemps.
All right, you got the thing finished.
Yeah.
How did you get it seen?
Three times a year, they'd have these festivals around the world, markets, film markets, where you would buy and sell independent movies like they were widgets. And there was this guy named Irvin Shapiro, and we would notice that his company always handled like George Romero movies and these creepy, scary Dario Argento movies. And we thought, well, maybe he'll get what it is that we've got. So we contacted him. He was 85 years old when we met him. This guy went all the way back to the 20s and was a really honorable guy. And he saw our film and said, well, it's not exactly Gone with the Wind, but I think we can make some money with it, because he knew who to sell it to. And he held our hand through the foreign sales market. We didn't know anything about that. It's like you make a movie, you show it in the States, forget about it. But we didn't know anything about, well, a lot of people sell their movie overseas to make their production costs back. And then all the profit from the States is gravy. And we didn't know anything about that. And he said, well, okay, here we'll sell it to England, Japan, Germany, Italy, France. We were like, wow, that's amazing. And we also thought we would get ripped off overseas and that we'd make all our big profit in the United States. And it turned out to be completely the opposite. Foreign companies were very fair with us. They gave us overage checks when the film did well. They kept track of our money, and the people in the States were just criminals.
You know, listening to you talk about this, you obviously had a good time. You have very fond memories of this. It's made your career in a lot of ways. I mean,
it gave you
an end to Hollywood.
Oh, absolutely. People, they bring up the Evil Dead question, and they usually are very tentative with it and hesitant because they think I'm going to say, I don't want to talk about that anymore. But I can relate everything that I've done today directly back in a connected link to that first crappy little horror film.
But on the other hand, a few minutes ago you said you cringe a little bit every time they say Bruce Campbell, best known for
Evil Dead. It's a two-edged sword. So eventually I'll just make peace with the whole thing and not worry about it one way or the other.
Bruce Campbell, on his new book, If Chins Could Kill, Confessions of a B-Movie Actor. Coming up, the kid who was almost as good as the Bard and other forgotten celebrities. Also an argument in favor of fame. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. The extravagant lives of celebrities are an easy target. But if Tyler Cowen had his way, we'd spend less time making fun of celebrities and more time being grateful. Cowen's the author of What Price Fame? And insists the culture of celebrity benefits society.
That's correct. I think celebrity culture is a good thing. It helps us communicate with others. It tells us something about ourselves. We identify with celebrities. There's something to talk about. They're emotional focal points for us.
Does it matter who they are, what kind of celebrity? I mean, are there good celebrities and bad celebrities?
Well, some celebrities are better than others. But I think the important point is that when the world needs better celebrities or better heroes, that they come along. And we've seen this in the response to the September 11th attacks, that we now have firemen, policemen as heroes, and that's when we need them. In the ordinary course of events, it's fine if we look to movie stars and basketball players.
You know, it's funny, isn't it? I read recently that in New York, I guess, Harrison Ford walked into a restaurant, and ordinarily you would expect people to rise up and gawk and turn their heads, and instead nobody much looked, but when a fire truck went by, everybody cheered.
That's right. I think it's exactly that process, that the supply of celebrities is driven by demand, and in hard times, people know to look for heroes rather than just celebrities. In good times, we're happy with celebrities.
And celebrities are quite commonly now leading us in our ideas. The celebrities are taking positions on political issues, celebrities supporting products. Is that a healthy thing?
Absolutely. When a celebrity supports a product, the point is not that the celebrity knows much about the product, but that the celebrity is willing to put up their reputation and endorse the product, and the agent of that celebrity will make sure the product is a pretty good one. So this is a signal to consumers that this is a certain kind of product or a product that they can buy with safety, and this works.
It works, and it doesn't bother me very much when we're talking about toothpaste or even on a refrigerator or an automobile or something that's going to cost you money. But when it comes to politics, doesn't it worry you a little that which movie star supports the candidate is more likely to influence your choice than what the candidate himself or herself thinks?
Well, I don't think we have a lot of evidence that movie star endorsements, in fact, swing elections. But if a person knows, say, the political views of Robert Redford, and Robert Redford endorses a candidate, and the person then thinks that candidate's for me, I don't think that's much different than when a friend does it. And in fact, it's an easy way for that person to get information.
And the fact that so many entertainers have jumped the fence and become candidates themselves, that too is just a reasonable part of celebrity culture?
I don't see anything wrong with it. That celebrity has to run for office and campaign and win the votes and win the campaign contributions. And I may not agree with the views of every celebrity in politics or even most of them, but they're subject to the same competitive process that other candidates are. They have to convince the voters they are the best person to lead the district or the country.
There are some other figures that you quote in your book that I found fascinating and a little bit disturbing. You said, for instance, that more people know who Princess Di was than know who their own senators are?
That's correct.
Doesn't that bother you?
Well, it depends what we think is going on in politics. Every state has two senators. And what are those senators out there doing? Do we think that they're out there fighting for the best interests of their state and for their country? And I think in large part they are. And in that sense, the system works. We have enough voters and enough forces in politics that do know what's going on, that it enforces a certain kind of behavior from politicians. And if you have some number of people out there who don't know what who their senator is, while I do think that's a shame, I think that's something that's bad, it's still the case it does not mean the end of the world. It does not mean the failure of politics.
I suppose you could even say there's some comfort in that because it suggests that we believe strongly enough in the security of our government that we don't need to know who our senators are, all of us, and that you can't avoid knowing who Princess Di is.
Absolutely. It tells us that in American politics, there's not actually so much at stake in normal times. And if you look at, say, the Eastern European countries after communism fell and they were searching for what they would be, what kind of system they would have, everyone in those societies knew who all of the politicians were and had passionate opinions about them. And this was appropriate for their circumstances. We're in a position where we have the luxury of not needing to do that, and we should take that as a sign and symptom of our political good health, not as a problem.
This brings us back, I think, to the question of how celebrity is established, how we get to paying attention to people. If more people visit Graceland than go to the White House, it's because Elvis Presley spent more time singing in our ears and appearing on television than Dwight Eisenhower or John F. Kennedy, even.
Graceland is also a better tour, I can say, having done both.
If famous people are entertainers for the most part, or Princess Di is the one who determines how we want to look, is there no sense in which it's taking away from things that might make us better people?
Well, celebrities have many effects on people, but one of the things celebrities have done is drawn people's attention to charities, drawn people's attention to the plight of the poor. Oprah has drawn people's attention to the value of reading books. So celebrity is a medium that can be put towards bad uses, but for the most part, celebrities survive by providing people with some kind of useful service, product, idea, inspiration, or whatever. And this will tend to be much more of a good thing than a bad thing.
Can you consciously choose to create celebrity?
People try to do this. In the 1960s, there was a rock and roll group called the Monkees who sat down and asked themselves, how can we make ourselves famous? And they tried to do it, and they succeeded. They didn't have a lot of musical muscle behind it all, but it worked. So one can do this. People who do that typically don't stay famous for that long. They become a kind of one-hit wonder, somewhat ephemeral. But again, those people serve a purpose as well. They're fun. The Monkees are fun. I still like listening to the Monkees, even though they might not have more than four or five good songs.
Tyler Cowen, the author of What Price Fame?
Here we come, walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet. Hey, hey, we're the Monkees, and people say we monkey around. But we're too busy singing to put anybody down. We go
where we want. You may think that once you've made it, actually established your claim to fame, the rest is history. As it happens, history has a rather short memory. Paul Collins is the author of Banvard's Folly, 13 Tales of Renowned Obscurity, Famous Anonymity, and Rotten Luck. He told Steve Paulson about the celebrated artist John Banvard, who used to be a household name.
His greatest painting became known as the Three Mile Painting, where it was rolled up on either side of a stage with cranks. And so you'd have someone working the crank at one side of the stage on these giant rollers, and the painting would sort of pass along. It was like the first motion picture. And this is in the late 1840s, 1850s. Banvard would be out front narrating this trip. He had painted a gigantic painting of the Mississippi River. And he'd been up and down the Mississippi many times himself. So he gave you this narrated journey down the Mississippi. Actually, depending on They wouldn't unroll it at the end of the show, so they would roll it back and forth. So depending on which show you went to, you'd either get the upstream tour or the downstream.
So this was a big show. A lot of people would come and pay to see him put on his show.
It was a tremendous success. He toured in Boston, London, Paris, New York. I mean, to give you some notion of how big of a success it was normally about 50 cents admission, and he became a millionaire. And this is in the 1850s when $1 million went quite a long way.
Wow. Well, you write that he was actually the most famous painter, the most famous artist in the world, and maybe the richest as well.
It's a pretty safe bet that he was the richest at his time. I don't know of any other millionaire painters at that time. You know, he did a showing for Queen Victoria, and he had a fan letter from Charles Dickens, and all kinds of writers referenced his work. Yeah, he was tremendously successful, and in fact, with all the money that he made off of it, he came back to the U.S. eventually and built a replica of Windsor Castle out on Long Island to live in and was doing just fine for a while. He just sort of, you know, settled in and more or less retired there. But he had collected a lot of artifacts at one point. He'd actually gone down the Nile to do a gigantic panoramic painting of the Nile as well and had collected all kinds of Egyptian artifacts. This was back before antiquities laws. And in the meantime, P.T. Barnum was becoming also famous and wealthy because of his museum in New York with a lot of artifacts that were of rather more dubious authenticity. And Banvard saw this and thought, hey, I can do that. I've got all these artifacts as well. I'm a good showman. And he was a good showman, but he wasn't as good as Barnum. And that was his undoing. He went head-to-head with Barnum in the museum business. And it was just almost shocking how quickly Barnum clobbered him.
And yet the irony is, at least from what you're saying, John Banvard actually had the better artifacts, but P.T. Barnum was the better showman.
Yeah, Banvard had the better building. It was better ventilated, better designed, had better stuff inside. But what Barnum knew and what Banvard didn't was how powerful advertising was. To the point where, I mean, Barnum would just lie in some of his ads about the stuff he had and about how wonderfully ventilated and cool his buildings were.
This was a big thing, how well ventilated your museum
was.
Yeah.
Well, because people complained about it a lot back then. I mean, this is before air conditioning, too. So that was a big draw, kind of, you know, today where people will go to movies to get out of the heat. And he just clobbered Banvard simply because he understood advertising better. And it took down most of Banvard's money, a lot of investors, many of whom promptly began to sue Banvard. The long and the short of it was that Banvard, who had been, you know, this millionaire living out in a castle out on Long Island, eventually wound up in a spare room in his son's house out in the Dakota frontier.
Wow.
And was buried in a pauper's grave. His family actually skipped out of town so that they wouldn't pay the funeral expenses. And none of his panoramic paintings survive. And you won't find a reference to him in really in any art reference book.
So none of his paintings are still around?
None of his panoramic ones. There are a few small panels, but the panoramic paintings themselves are, nobody knows what happens to them. There's one rumor that they were shredded to create insulation for local homes in Watertown, South Dakota. So that's maybe the most ignominious end I could think of for his work.
Well, it's a fascinating case study of fame, how this enormous celebrity, this very rich guy who was celebrated by his fellow Americans in the mid-19th century, how he fell into total obscurity.
It's really shocking, actually. And when I first came across him, I came across like a couple lines about him in a book by Van Wyck Brooks, written in the 1930s. It was actually a literary history where he was talking about Whitman, and he was comparing this grandiose vision of America to these vast panoramic paintings. And when I read about it, I thought, that's interesting. I've never heard of this guy. And it just blew me away that someone like that could be forgotten. But what I came to realize was that that's not an uncommon experience. I think Banvard is one of the more extreme cases, but there's a lot of people like that. We tend, I think, to assign a few figureheads to each era, to each decade that we choose to remember and that sort of represent that time. But there's actually a whole multitude of other people who are as well known and maybe even better known back then that end up being forgotten.
So the question then is, why are some people remembered while others are totally forgotten?
I think there's a couple factors to it. I mean, I think that one is it's just what we find useful. Because we find certain aesthetic qualities pleasing, we'll tend to remember some artists better than others. That's why we remember Emily Dickinson. And yet at the same time, well, someone else I write about in the book, Martin Tupper, was one of the most popular and well-known poets of the day. He sold like 1.5 million copies of a book called Proverbial Philosophy. You know, people would chase him for locks of his hair. He's been out of print for a century.
Now, all of these cases that we've been talking about so far were well-meaning attempts for people to make their mark on the world. But there were some cases of chicanery. For instance, there was
I couldn't resist.
Well, there was this one kid, for instance, who claimed that he had discovered Shakespeare's lost plays and original letters and that kind of thing.
William Henry Ireland. Yeah, he's great. He was about, I guess, 18 years old and working as the clerk in a law office. And he had a well-known father. His father was a well-known engraver and collector of antiquarian books. And his son was considered not very smart. But William had a lot of free time working in this law office. It wasn't a very busy place. And so he started trying to forge Shakespearean documents, at first just as a lark. And then he brought one home one day to show to his father. And his father was completely taken in.
But how did he make them look old?
What he would do is, it being a law office, there were a lot of old legal documents sitting around, some of which were hundreds of years old. And so he would cut the blank pages off of these documents and use that as his paper. So it was genuine old paper. This was in the 1790s that this was happening. And he also found a printer who was able to create for him a type of ink that when you held it over a flame for a moment, it kind of oxidized and looked kind of like an old brown ink. And so it was a very convincing forgery. And in fact, the prime minister, the poet laureate, Boswell, all these luminaries came to visit the Ireland's household and look at these documents. And I think Boswell wept when he saw them. People were completely convinced for some time.
So what were these documents purported to be?
Well, initially, he wasn't too ambitious about it. He just did legal documents because he figured that no one would think that those were fake. But then he started getting a little bit more ambitious and started telling his father that he had found entire manuscripts of plays, of Hamlet, things like that. And then he reached a little too far and said he had found an original play called Vortigern. And William Henry Ireland, who at this point was only 19 years old, in 2 months wrote an entire quote-unquote Shakespearean play. And I might add, doing almost all this work on the play while at work in his law office. So he'd have to like hide it when the cleaning lady came in.
And this was a guy who was supposed to be not too swift in the head.
And well, in fact, the few people that did think that they might be forgeries blamed his father, because absolutely nobody thought that the son was smart enough to do this. No one ever suspected him. And in fact, what happened was the playwright Sheridan took up the play Vortigern and put it on one night. And at that point, a book had just been published to debunk these papers. And so what occurred was a riot at the first showing of Vortigern, to the point where there was a member of parliament in the crowd who was screamingly drunk, and he got up and mooned the entire audience. So it was a pretty out of control performance, and it was not a performance that was repeated. That was the first and last showing of Vortigern.
Paul Collins is the author of Banvard's Folly. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you have questions or comments on the show, you can write to us at To the Best of Our Knowledge, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. Or send us an email through our website at www.wpr.org/book. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Seeing Stars, number 1014B.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Winston Churchill once said, "In wartime, truth is so precious that she should always be attended by a bodyguard of lies." Next week on To the Best of Our Knowledge, journalist Jake Tapper discusses the ethics of telling lies during wartime. And we'll take a concise look at the history of lying, including Operation Mincemeat. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.